Okay, great, thanks. Good morning. So I'd like to thank the organisers for the invitation to speak today. So today I'm going to talk about some of the ways that machine learning and artificial intelligence are starting to kind of impact on the way that we do our work in AstraZeneca, and particularly at the kind of early stage of drug discovery. So why are we interested in artificial intelligence? So a recent study from within AstraZeneca looking at why drugs fail found that although there's been a considerable improvement, the drugs are still failing due to safety and efficacy. And essentially what this means is that when we actually put the drugs in humans for the first time, they're not doing what we expect them to do and what we predicted that they would do. And so that means that our earlier models, we really need to extract more information from them and derive a better understanding of the disease biology at an earlier stage. And so this is where we think that machine learning tools can help us with this. So Ian has already introduced quantitative biology. So we're kind of a broadly overlapping four disciplines. So I'm in the image analytics, with the laser pointer, image analytics group. But essentially, this artificial intelligence is starting to kind of spread out and kind of overlap with pretty much everything that we're doing. So today, I'm just going to talk about kind of two main themes. Firstly, how you actually, the problem of generating training data for machine learning models. And this is where the training data is the most expensive part. And so if we can have efficient ways of doing this, or clever ways of doing this, then we can save a lot of time and money and improve our models. And then also I'll talk about how we're starting to build these tools into our cellular screening workflows. Okay, so the training data, so the first example that I'm going to show is to do with time-lapse microscopy. And so what we're wanting to do is to track cells over time, going through cell divisions, and study when we add a compound or a drug, how is this influencing how cells divide? Do they stop? Do they die? At what point in the cell division cycle do they die? And so the images that we get look like this. We can track cells over time. This cell's about to divide. And what we want to be able to do is to automatically classify the cell phenotype and say what it's doing at a certain time, how long does it spend in any of these phases. So this is a normal cell, and this is a cell that's going to fail to divide and die in a certain way. And then this next cell is going to do something similar, but there's subtle differences in the appearance, which means that we actually want to be able to distinguish between these two kinds of phenotypes. And so because there's quite a few different classes that we want to classify our data into, we need a large amount of training data to do this. And if we were to build this in a kind of a naive way of just manually selecting and classifying cells that we see in our data set, not only would this be incredibly slow, but there would also be a lot of redundancy in that, in that a lot of these cells look very similar, and so we'll be adding cells that the model already knows how to classify. And so it won't actually, the training data that we're adding won't actually be generating value to our model. And so what we do to get around this is, based on a small set of training data, we then classify all the remaining sample and then look for specifically samples within that data set that aren't well classified, that we don't have a good confidence of prediction. So these are the cells which will provide value to our model and give us more information. So we extract these cells and then present them to the user for efficient classification. We can do this in an iterative way and rapidly build up a valuable training set that's got a very kind of, there's less redundancy there in that training, in that data set. And so this concept of kind of making sure that the confidence of our training, although here it's only user time essentially that's been saved, we can think of it from a totally different perspective. So now we're using this to classify lots of different phenotypes, and that allows us to then look at the how cells behave over time, and when a cell dies, look at what point in its previous history did it cause a defect. But so as I was saying, we can then apply this kind of thinking to a totally different space, and this is to do with chemical compound activity. And here, the training data is essentially the ground truth. So to get that data, we have to manufacture the compound and then test it. And so if we can have a model that makes predictions on this, it can save us a lot of chemical synthesis. So essentially, we want to build a model based on features or descriptors of the compound to make a prediction on the activity of that compound. Once we've built up a reasonable model, what we can then do here is make a prediction on how confident are we that it's an active compound or how confident are we that it's an inactive compound. I think the frowny face has disappeared here. But essentially, by making this kind of confidence prediction, we can then identify compounds which we're fairly sure are bad. So that means we don't need to synthesize these and test them, because we, based on our model, we already know that they'll be bad. But also, we get a confidence prediction on whether they'll be good, whether they'll be active. And so if we're very confident in this, we then don't need to actually test those compounds. We can manufacture them, but we don't need to then destroy and waste the compounds by actually doing the tests. So by using this kind of confidence of prediction, we can actually only synthesize the compounds that we need to. These compounds here are here that will actually improve our model and that we're uncertain of. And so when we think of training data in terms of resource, then there really is a lot to be gained by being more efficient or more intelligent at how we collect our training data. Okay, so the next theme that I was going to talk about is how we're integrating this into our cellular screening workflows. There's a few examples from this, and the first one is kind of the more traditional way that we think about machine learning. And so this is image-based transcriptomics. So typically you can label mRNA, so the output of a gene, in single cells with a fluorescent label, and then you can count these kind of fluorescent spots within a cell. But this is kind of low throughput, because you then get only one gene you can label at a time. And so this kind of transcriptomic approach does this in a combinatoric way, so that you label a subset of genes, image them, then strip that label off, label another subset of genes, image those, and do this for a number of rounds. And the more rounds you do, the more different species and the more different genes you can measure the activity of. And so you can see here that you can build up, by doing this kind of iterative rounds of imaging, you can build up and measure the gene activity of potentially up to 1,000 genes at single cell level, and maintain that kind of spatial information. And so by integrating this as a workflow, we can now start to count the amount of gene expression in individual cells, and not only look at the kind of the average and the distributions of our gene expression, but also look for subpopulations that have a particular fingerprint of gene expression. But then when you look at the actual data that comes out, you can see that there's kind of clustering of certain types of gene, and things like the spatial interaction between cells. There's a huge amount of data here that we're not really using just in these kind of outputs. And so what can we learn by these kind of data mining approaches? And I say this is the kind of traditional kind of machine learning where we generate a huge amount of data and then kind of mine it. But now we're starting to integrate these methods actually into the way that we do our experiments. And so a good example of this is label-free segmentation. And so the problem that we have here is that for typical cellular imaging, we usually have to label with a nuclear marker and a cell marker in order to robustly identify where cells are in the image. And this uses up a number of channels. And what we'd like to be able to do is to use all of our color channels in our fluorescence microscope to label interesting biology. So this could be different genes within a pathway so that we can see where perturbations are occurring, or it could be looking for subpopulations if we label particular cell subtypes. So we'd like to be able to use all of these fluorescent channels for interesting biological questions. And so our solution to this is to use the label-free phase contrast image to do our cellular segmentation. Now, this would be a very difficult challenge for us to do as humans and to design an algorithm. So instead, we just use a deep learning approach trained on fluorescently labeled nuclei and fluorescently labeled cells. And when we do this, we can see how the network learns to extract features from the image, and it derives patterns at longer and longer length scales, and then recombines these patterns back down to the pixel level to make a prediction about which pixels belong to nuclei and which pixels belong to the background. And so we can do this for our cells, and we can derive a segmentation from the label-free image. And this means that we no longer have to use half of our imaging channels for this kind of segmentation, and it frees up a lot of channels that we can now use. But we can take this a step further. So the phase contrast image contains a lot of morphological and textural information, and what information is contained in there. And so one thing we'd like to derive is the cell cycle status. So has the DNA replicated? Is it about to divide? Or has it just divided? And so this is typically measured in a fluorescent stain. But we can use a transfer learning approach to train the fluorescent output to be predicted from these image regions. And when we do that, we can recapitulate the cell cycle distribution. But now, because this is a label-free approach, we don't need to fix our cells. We don't need to spend a lot of time and effort engineering cell lines with fluorescent markers. We can just use the unengineered cells, and there's no phototoxicity, no photo damage. So this is really an example of how the kind of machine learning and artificial intelligence is starting to change the kind of experiments that we can do. But the kind of what we'd like to be able to do is, rather than designing a specific workflow, a specific part of our image analysis, we'd like to just let the machine learn how to do that. And so a good example from this is the kind of organ on a chip work, where these kind of small devices made of polymer are designed and engineered to recapitulate the kind of function of a human organ. So this particular one, you get hearts, you get heart on a chip, and kidney on a chip. This particular one is a liver on a chip. And these really have the potential to improve the prediction of what's going to happen when we test our compound in humans. Now, the drawback to this is that because these systems are so new, they're also not very well validated. So a lot of the methods that we use in two-dimensional tissue culture don't necessarily transfer directly to these new systems. And so what this means is that rather than manually designing an endpoint and looking at the images and deciding how to measure the differences between the image, what we'd like to do is just to allow the machine to learn this. So we can calculate, based on our fluorescent endpoints that we measure, we can calculate a whole bunch of textural and morphological features, and you can see how they cluster depending on different treatments, and then just use the machine to learn what the differences are. So if we then learn the difference between a positive and a negative control, we can then look at our feed our test compound images into that classification, and then we can actually see, we can actually see this kind of dose response when we use our test compound. And this comes, so we can see that there's a concentration response and also a time response. And this comes purely from feeding the images into the machine without having to design any algorithm to measure it. And again, it's down to our choice of training data that we use. And so we can go a step further and take the kind of training data out and go for a purely unsupervised approach. So this is using the variational autoencoder approach that Carol has already mentioned. And essentially what this is doing is it's taking the information that's in the image and then compressing it down into a smaller number of dimensions. And the variational part, the probabilistic part, helps to ensure that the spatial coordinates have a meaning, so that points that are close together in our latent space correspond to similar image appearance, and then points that are kind of sparse and well separated correspond to rarer appearances of image. So we can use this to kind of automatically look for our outliers. So looking at cells at a high density, this corresponds to our typical types of image. But if we look at the very sparse regions, we can then filter out our artifacts. And so this is an unsupervised approach for looking at what part of this feature space is the artifacts, and that we can then remove them with an efficient manual annotation. And the other interesting thing about this is that looking at that latent feature space, you automatically start to see clusters. And so there is potential here to use those clusters to identify interesting phenotypes in our image, ones that we might not expect to see from our control data. This is kind of a summary of some of the tools that we're currently using, but what are the challenges that we actually face in integrating this together and using it further? So I think in all of our situations, the limited training data that we have on the cost of generating that training data is still a real challenge. And so there's a few kind of standard ways of doing this, so using a pre-trained model, using transfer learning, augmenting the data. And this works particularly well for images because you can rotate and flip and add noise to the images to make sure that our network doesn't kind of, it's not limited by the amount of training data. That kind of the autoencoding approach that I just talked about can be used kind of pre-train a model. But I think what all of these kind of work to an extent, but there is still a limit as to how we can actually, we don't want to be generating training data on a case-by-case basis, so for a particular assay. And so I think the multitask learning approach is a very promising one where you, especially for kind of cellular imaging data, because the images look very similar each time, so we can kind of build a network which shares the more abstract layers, the first layers, across several different problems, and then have a problem-specific set of classification layers. So I think this would be an approach would be very well suited to the kind of cellular imaging problems that we have. And the other kind of problem, as we start to do more and more of this work, is being able to integrate different image modalities. So it's all very well being able to take a single experiment and do something with it, but how do we then compare this experiment with an experiment that's been captured on a different microscope, or take an imaging experiment and compare it with a sequencing experiment or a gene expression experiment? And so all of these things, a lot of these things are to do with making sure that the metadata is available and is searchable so that we can actually aggregate together all of this data. But then once we've done that, there's the question of how do we actually encode relevant features to make sure that the imaging data is comparable to non-imaging, to sequencing, for instance. And so this is a very fast-moving area. And so there's a couple of things which I just pulled out that I think are quite interesting. So looking at adversarial networks, I don't know if this has come up. So there's supposed to be a Google Street, Google Maps kind of view of what this aerial view. And so these kind of networks are very useful for kind of converting images to images. And so for instance, making labeling an unlabeled image, or doing the reverse, taking labels on an image and actually generating a photorealistic image. But I think the real promise of these kind of adversarial network approaches is that we actually set two networks off against each other to learn how to do the discrimination, rather than kind of hand-tuning and hand-designing the objective function that we're looking for. So it's kind of taking humans further out of the equation. I think that's why it's quite promising. And the other area for kind of data set, cross data set comparisons is this kind of sequence to sequence encoding from Google. And you can see here where it's used for kind of translation for so sequences of different lengths and arbitrary lengths, encoding that into a latent feature space, and then decoding that back into a different space. And so there's kind of the more obvious applications where taking an image and generating a caption, and so we can think this would be quite useful in the image data that we're generating to automatically pull out a human readable description of what the content of the images is. But I think there's also a more impactful application of this, in that the latent encoding that's here represents what's contained in the data, rather than the modality of the data itself. So we could potentially think about converting images and converting that back to the output of a qPCR experiment, or looking at how the different, completely different modalities, where's the shared information there, and what predictions does one experiment make about the output of another experiment. So I think there's a lot of really key research to be done in this kind of area. So we've used a lot of kind of specific problem solving at the moment. But as we build and try and, as Carola was saying, trying to bring all of this together into a workflow that's more automated and doesn't require us to design every step. And I think there's some real impact that can be generated from doing this. I think my acknowledgements are missing. But all of this data has been generated by a huge number of experimentalists. I think this is one of the areas where it's a really great environment in AstraZeneca, because as the quantitative biologists, we have access to these vast range of types of experiments and types of data, and so I think it's a very rewarding place to be. Okay, great. So thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Adam. Any questions?
Yeah. So you talked a lot about automation, and you guys are putting in a lot of effort into machine learning and artificial intelligence. My question is, what platform does AstraZeneca use for its AI efforts? What's the name of the platform?
You mean in terms of the...
For example, if you go to aerospace industry, from conception to the CNC codes that go to build the parts, the car, whatever it is, they use something like CATIA. It's the name of a software, right? So everything stays on board, and every time you click on something, you got a lot of machine learning going on in different modules, but the effort is maximized by having this platform. So for this drug development, what is the name of the AstraZeneca's platform? Because for other people for universities to get involved, to maximize effort, you need a platform. So what, at the strategic level, what is the name of the platform?
So I think that's probably an ongoing quest at the moment. So as we're kind of building our computing capabilities, it's become obvious that we need to actually get this together into a single consistent approach.
Yeah, from conception to, okay.
And so I think I would say that's probably still ongoing at the moment. So it's not something that can be just from the outside just dipped into like that. But I think it's a really good point, and that we are aware that that's how it needs to be in order to actually maximize this.
So these efforts that you're doing, are they staying on certain hard drives, or are you guys putting into work some mechanism to save all this work, to, you know, because the next person coming in after you to do continue from this, or is it going to be handover manually, or?
So I think the good thing is that we do publish as much as we can. And so there is support for actually making code available, making these things. And so we do that wherever we can. I think a lot of what I've talked about here is at this kind of testing stage. So it's not been implemented yet. So I think it's...
No, I understand. I attended the meeting where even when they do tests, they stay on board of the platform.
No, I think that is a really good, it's a really valuable thing to do. But I think because it's such a huge company with lots of people doing lots of different things, although we know that this is something that we need to be doing, it's taken a while to bring that all together. But it's happening, and so I think it's one of the things that we do want to achieve.
Yeah, I mean, aerospace, they've got a million parts as well. It's got to fly up in the air. So, I mean, you know, they're also doing big things.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree. But I think it's something that's still ongoing, so it's not something that is ready yet.
Maybe just a bit of a follow-on comment on this big question. So we're actually at the stage of building something so-called scientific compute platform. So basically, kind of we're renovating our kind of a computational platform and using kind of cloud-based object store-based system. And we're trying to actually tackle exactly what I just said there. So, and then there's a number of different phases, as Adam said. So, and the first thing first, we're trying to actually tackle the data aspect. Where do we put our data? How do we store it? How do we define different way of preserving the data? When to delete? And how do we actually find and search our data? From the data level, we're trying to build something first. Then afterwards, it's typically going to be, so once the data is in place, then we'll have to define our better way of processing data in a bit more centralized way, if that's the way actually to go, which we don't know yet. So at the moment, right, like different parts of the company are doing different experiments on different platforms. Are we going to unify everything into one platform? We don't know yet, but however, we just have to find it out, I suppose.
There's no other option, but I mean, this has to be a formal movement, which means that you got to work with GSK on this. And with other companies,
we are working with GSK on this. Actually,
yeah, you have no other choice. Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions? All right. So if not, Adam, can I ask you a quick question? So, for you as a researcher, scientist working in a pharma company, in your perspective, you're working in the industry. Then, what would you like to see to collaborate with our academic partners? What kind of help would you like to get?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, so what I've talked about today is looking at very kind of specific problem solving. So where we have something that needs doing, and then we can bring in a tool and do that. But I think the real power of these approaches is when we start to string them together, when we start to integrate across different methods. So I think that's really where an academic partnership can help with this, and where we can derive real impact, is looking at the kind of, what kinds of, so it's easy for us to take an existing model architecture and apply it to solve a problem, but what should we be thinking about in terms of how to make these models more trainable, how to make these models communicate with each other? So it's kind of that next step that I think is where we really need the help. And I think it's really encouraging to hear what Carola was saying earlier about that kind of stuff is already in motion.
Just wondering, you mentioned a range of machine learning techniques, ranging from unsupervised to perhaps supervised. In the context of biology and biological modeling, where the systems evolved in some sense, right? How would you use supervised learning? I mean, how would you get your ground truth in your supervised data? Because I think that's the hardest one for me conceptually to see.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the kind of the current way of training data is kind of training it to do what we already do. So a human looks at it and kind of labels and annotates things. And I think that's already not something which is going to be useful in the long term, because we want to be able to outperform what we can do. So I think there's a lot of interesting areas looking at sort of imperfect training data or corrupted training data, where you don't have to be 100% sure about what the labeling is. I think that's a very interesting area. things like conformal prediction, where alongside your predictions, you also have a confidence of how confident you are in what those predictions are. So I think that's kind of moving more towards this kind of uncertainty in where we get our labels from. But I mean, in terms of some of the impact that we can generate, the especially if you think about in the kind of the safety space, the kind of the labels are the what it ultimately does in humans, and we already have a lot of data for what compounds do, a lot of clinical trial data, a lot of safety data, and so when we look at a new imaging screen or a new imaging modality, I think what the power of that will be then training it on to make predictions about what will ultimately happen when we go into humans. And I think that's the kind of training data that I think will be quite powerful.
I think a comment on that would be, so from my perspective, lots of the problems we're facing in medicine, the accuracy requirement from us may not be that high. For example, if you have to publish a mathematical paper, you probably have to claim something like 90-something percent accuracy. But however, in some of the applications we are facing, 70% is pretty good. 80% is definitely useful for us to actually push into our business as usual, as a piece of tool and actually use on a daily basis. So in our industry, the requirement actually may not be that high. So which means that the work you potentially have done can be actually used immediately. And although it's like it may not be seem to be that good numbers, which means that in another way saying this, we are tolerant, sorry, we're pretty tolerant in terms of if the data, train data actually dirty, not really nicely labeled, but potentially all right for us.
But I think there's also ways that if you know that the training data is corrupted in some way, then I think there's work that can be done to improve that rather than just naively using it. And so I think that's one of the things where like a research approach can help.
Okay, thank you very much, Adam. Let's give a round of applause to Adam and then introduce the next speaker, Carla. Thank you.